Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here with John Vecchione. And Vec, I wanted to talk about this week's hearing in the Western District of Michigan. A couple of our colleagues, Harriet Hageman, who has sat in your chair for this show in the past, was one of our attorneys for the New Civil Liberties Alliance arguing that case. And Janine Yunus was the other attorney up there arguing for us. And this is the case of Norris v. Michigan State University. And there are a fair number of issues in the case, but I think it really boils down to your constitutional right to bodily integrity and whether or not the government can overcome that constitutional right to bodily integrity by force vaccinating you with the COVID vaccine. And one of the questions specific to this case is whether they can do that to somebody who already has naturally acquired immunity. Now, we've talked about that on this show before, that naturally acquired immunity is, there's no magic to it. There's nothing COVID specific about it, in the sense that this is something that you acquire, that folks can acquire to other diseases as well. If you've had chickenpox and you get over the chickenpox, then you have some resistance built up that helps you to not get it again. And it's the same idea here. If you've had COVID and you've recovered from it, then you have these antibodies and B cells and T cells in your system that help prevent you from getting COVID a second time. And that natural immunity is the level of antibodies that you have from natural immunity is exactly what they use to determine whether or not a vaccine is working or not, or whether it's producing the sort of reaction that they want the vaccine to produce. And so those issues were being debated this week up in the Western District of Michigan. Yeah, Vec, go ahead.
And Mark, it's just so well recognized that in almost all the states, whenever they have a vaccine mandate for school, if you've had the disease, it doesn't apply to you. It's like written into the law. It's not like something that just come up with COVID.
No, that's right. It's established public policy, including in Michigan, because we looked into that if you have had, whether it's mumps or measles or chickenpox, whatever it is, that these various vaccines you have to get before you go to kindergarten or public school, if you've had those diseases and you carry the antibodies, you don't have to get the shots for those particular diseases. You still have to get the other ones, but you don't have to get the one for which you already have natural immunity. And so the question, specific question before the court, is, can the state make you take the vaccine if you already have natural immunity? And then there's another layer to that, because what the state says is, well, we're not making you take the vaccine. We're just firing you from your job as a professor or staff member at Michigan State University if you don't take the vaccine. It's your free choice. But the problem with that, Vec, is that's an unconstitutional condition. You're being coerced into giving up a constitutional right, that being the right to bodily integrity. And the state was arguing in court this week that, no, just because it's a hard decision doesn't mean it's coerced. So, well, look, if you're being forced to give up your job, most people would consider that it may not be your money or your life, but it's still very coercive. It's losing your job is short of a gun to your head, but it's still a very coercive sort of condition to put on there.
And as you remember, to that question, your money or your life, Jack Benny would always make that long pause and say, I'm thinking.
Well, the one of the features of the hearing that took place in Kalamazoo, Michigan, was that we had the opportunity to put an expert witness on the stand, Dr. Norcasm, Hooman Norcasm, and he was able to talk about some of the science that's involved with natural immunity and explain to the court that these folks do not pose a risk to their colleagues, because the obviously the argument for forced vaccination is that if you're walking around with COVID and you're exposing a bunch of other people to COVID, then you're harming others, right? And so that sort of harm to others becomes the rationale for constraining your conduct or making you do something that you don't want to do. But the court was I think, stopped short or was stunned when it learned that Michigan State University accepts the Sinovac vaccine. That's the one that China came up with, which is only 50% effective. And it's well known and well understood that the Sinovac vaccine is only 50% effective. It has not been approved by the FDA. It has been approved by the World Health Organization. And when the when this fact came up, the defense said, well, it's been approved by the World Health Organization. And the judge said, well, if WHO has approved it, you know, clearly that was not, that didn't impress him much, given the, I don't know whether it was just the fact that it wasn't FDA approved or the fact that that WHO has had a bit of a collusion problem with China. So the fact that they would approve the vaccine didn't impress him. But in any event, the factual issue around the vaccine is that it's only 50% effective. So if you have a vaccine that's only 50% effective, that means half the people on your campus who had that vaccine are able to spread the disease to other people if they come down with it. And so how is that different from natural immunity? I mean, it's clearly worse than natural immunity, where whatever you think the percentage is of spread from people with natural immunity, it's certainly above 50%. So there's this arbitrariness to the decision making process at Michigan State, where they're willing to take that Sinovac vaccine coming in primarily from foreign students who are paying full freight tuition, and so there's an economic incentive for the university to accept that vaccine, and yet they want to impose this forced vaccination on faculty and staff of the university. So that seemed to be something that the judge was not impressed with. But one of the other issues that came up is this sort of police power issue. And we've talked about this before, Vec, that the police power is something that the federal government does not have. The states have. It's one of the powers reserved to the states and to the people in the Constitution. And to the extent that the police power exists in the state legislature, then if the legislature has not approved whatever this policy is, then what Michigan State University is doing isn't approved. And so part of the argument to the judge was, look, the state legislature has spoken. They have established a public policy along the lines of what Vec was talking about earlier, that natural immunity exists in these other contexts and is recognized in these other contexts. They have not spoken specifically to COVID and natural immunity in the COVID context. But what's happened here is that the university isn't acting based on what the state legislature has said or on what state public policy is. They're acting based on federal guidance, not binding law, but guidance from the CDC and FDA and so forth. And they're bypassing the state legislature in that way. Now, the state's argument is that under the state constitution, Michigan State University has its own delegation, or the universities in Michigan have their own delegation of police power to control their citizen or the people on their campuses, and to provide for the health and safety of the people on their campuses. But it's not clear that's true. That's one of the bones of contention in the case, is sort of how extensive that constitutional remit is for the universities. But if the universities don't have police power, then it's pretty clear that the state legislature hasn't given it to them on this issue. So that's another factor to consider. Vec, what do you think that is going to happen here? Was there another factor that jumped out at you from the sort of the report that we got?
Yeah, it does strike me that the government in the state, they're allowing a couple of things that make natural immunity look better, right? You've pointed out one. They also have religious exemptions, and they have there was one other exemption that I thought didn't make full sense, but What I don't understand, I do think
well, the judge pointed out that our client is a remote employee.
Oh, that's it. Yes. Yeah. That's exactly it. I think the fact that we have so many remote workers now who don't come in and don't have any contact to anyone. So you in order to have a communicable disease be deadly, you have to communicate it to people. And if you're out in your bunker and you are operating from there and you're not talking to anyone, what really is their interest in getting you vaccinated? As a school, who are you harming? And so I do think that there's a confluence of problems with this rule. I don't think it's going to help the unvaccinated who've never had COVID. I don't think it's really what we're focusing on here, it strikes me, is if you're going to follow the science. And I think the science is pretty clear that if you've had COVID is not different in this immune response
dynamic.
It's just like I'll give you an example. The flu. Well,
there are two other points I wanted to get in that came out in the hearing that I think our listeners will want to know about. One is that on the stand, their expert, Dr. Zervos, was asked if he could guarantee that if our client got the vaccine, that she wouldn't suffer any harm from that. And he hemmed and hawed, but he wouldn't say that. He would not say that. He said that she needed to consult with her doctor and make a decision, which is kind of the opposite of the blanket one size fits all policy that Michigan State University is trying to force down. They also said that they kept talking about how the FDA recommended the shot for the vaccine, even for people who have natural immunity. But what they ignored is that the CDC and the FDA guidance does not mandate not taking natural immunity into account. But that's what Michigan State's policy does. It refuses to take natural immunity into account. One of the consequences of that is that even the consensus recommendation from FDA and CDC for people with natural immunity is to only get one dose of the vaccine. But under Michigan State's policy, they would have to get both doses of the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine. So they're not even really following the CDC and FDA recommendations. But we'll see what happens. We'll keep you apprised. We'll be right back. We're back on Administrative Static, and Vec, for this segment, I wanted to talk about something that really irks me, which is the different rules that seem to apply to the Department of Justice and the federal government anytime we are litigating against them. And this is something that I suspect that most practitioners who are in federal court a lot have experienced, but since almost all of our cases are against the federal government in one form or another, we see this happening all the time and repeatedly. And I think it's a suitable topic to address with a rule change. And I'll talk about one pending rule change here in a minute that I think goes in the wrong direction. But we have several examples where the federal government, for example, is not held to deadlines in litigation. And of course, if we ever miss a deadline, the court is apt to dismiss the case or take other punitive action against our clients. But for some reason, the federal government routinely gets away with blowing past deadlines. And this conduct takes several forms. And I don't, you know, feel free if you want to jump in with a specific example, Vec. I don't want to jump in.
It's not just NCLA. It's anyone. If you're a plaintiff's attorney, if you're a defense attorney, if you're any non-governmental lawyer trying to get a break, you know, you're held to a standard that the government on deadlines doesn't seem to have to meet.
That's right. And I didn't mean to suggest it was NCLA specific, so I'm glad you clarified that. This is anyone who's litigating against the government runs into this problem. But for example, we've had a federal district judge issue a stay order in one of our cases that where the judge had previously explicitly stayed one deadline, but said that all the other deadlines are still in effect. So, you know, naturally, we complied with the next deadline that came up. And rather than reply to our motion on the appointed day, The government submitted a motion on that day without any substantive briefing attached, saying, you know, asking the judge, did you really mean to stay just the one deadline, or are these other deadlines stayed too? And the court responded, I'm not sure if the court's responded yet, or if the court responded by letting the government off the hook.
They then said, "Nah, we meant it all. We meant everything. So that one doesn't bother that. Okay, the judge decided that. But what really bothers me is that when the court acts and says to the guy, you know, it's like I'll turn this car around, right? And they tell them that they've got to get something in at a certain time. But if they don't, there's no penalty because you can't. It's like you can't sanction the government.
They're not willing to. I mean, these are magic deadlines. Whether it's an extension that the government seems to always get its extension, whether you object to it or not. And if they fail to meet a deadline, then it seems like they're routinely excused in circumstances where we would never be excused. Let me just put one little fine point on that. If we were asking for something like this at the deadline, if the government didn't think that a particular deadline applied, then as soon as we put in our brief, they could say, "Oh my gosh, I'm surprised that NCLA just put in a brief on this. We thought these deadlines were all stayed. What's going on?" If they did that on the day we filed or the day after we filed, then you'd say, "Oh, okay, well, there was a genuine misunderstanding here." But when they wait till the last day, like 14 days later or 30 days later, whatever it happens to be, to then ask the court.
They didn't do that.
But we've seen it before where the deadline, correct. They have, and it's not like on the deadline, they submit a substantive brief. No. And say, here's our response. But by the way, wasn't this supposed to be stayed? They don't give us the substantive response. And that creates several kinds of unfairness, as I'm sure that you can appreciate. But first of all, our team wastes time preparing a motion. Second, the government will now have weeks and weeks to prepare a response to a motion that we, rather than the amount of time that the government should have under the rules, they have a much longer period of time to respond to. Third, the government didn't have to spend hardly any time preparing its motion. It would be bad, like I say, it'd be bad if the government prepared a substantive response on deadline and sought clarification as to future deadlines. But doing this dance on the deadline really results in lopsided workloads and preparation schedules. And then fourth, the government, in the event of an event of genuine misunderstanding, could have sought direction sooner. Sounds like they did in this case, but we've had other times when they haven't. And by waiting until the deadline to inquire, it generates additional internal scheduling problems for us, right? We're clearing space and time to read and react to incoming briefs on the deadline. And when the government waits till the last minute, that's a strategic kind of behavior. The other thing we see, John, is that they sometimes time their extensions in ways that cause us to have to work over Thanksgiving or work over Christmas. And it happens routinely that they time their extensions in ways that maximize the inconvenience for the non-governmental party. And the courts let them get away with this all the time. And
The other thing is the law is that the government can't default, right? So any private party can be defaulted and lose their case, but the federal government cannot be defaulted in federal court. So that is another thing. What do you do? If they can't lose the case by not responding, and maybe the lawyers could be sanctioned, but that doesn't happen very often. But the fact that they can't be defaulted ever, and everybody else can, that's a powerful disequilibrium.
It is. It is that. And at other times, the government, when they submit a request for stay rather than filing a brief on deadline, the court could just sit on that request for a week or 2 weeks. And so even if it's eventually denied, the government, by using this tactic, often is able to buy extra time for the preparation of their briefs. And it's just wrong under the rules for one side to have more time than the other side to prepare what it's doing. And I suspect this kind of thing happens very fairly often. We're certainly seeing it happen fairly routinely. And it's something that it gives the government this procedural benefit on a regular basis. It's hard enough to win cases against the government, right? The government has extensive resources, lots of lawyers they can throw at something. We often find that if we're in a case, if we're throwing one or two lawyers at it, there'll be five or six lawyers at least on the other side. I think you saw this in your trial down in Florida, John.
There's also doctrines. Don't forget all the doctrines they have for defense. You know,
mootness and ripeness and that, all that kind of stuff.
Everything. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's like Indiana Jones trying to go get that thing at the beginning. You're like leaping over spikes and you're coming over holes.
Watch for the giant boulder rolling behind you. And, yeah. you're absolutely right. But I guess my question is, why do federal judges? I mean, they have enough of these. What I guess I would call legitimate in the case of ripeness and mootness and so forth, enough of these legitimate sort of ways of tilting the scale in their favor that judges really shouldn't be bending over backwards to cater to the Department of Justice procedurally. It makes it even harder and less fair. And by the way, a lot of times if you're up against the government, certainly if you're a defendant, but even if you're not, a lot of times having that sort of Damocles hanging over your head is really difficult, right? Especially if you're paying for your counsel, you're racking up bills. It's very expensive. And so to have to wait 30 days or 45 days or 60 days instead of 15 days can be the difference between actually getting to mount a defense and not being able to mount a defense because you've run out of money. And so that's the other reason why I think judges shouldn't be bending over backwards to extend these deadlines for the government. But there's one particular deadline that I wanted to mention, because there's a pending federal rule, and this is pending in front of the Civil Rules Advisory Committee. They're preparing to consider a Rule 12A4 amendment that would extend the federal government's time to respond from 14 days to 60 days. And I believe that this is limited to one particular circumstance, and that's when a federal official is being sued in their personal capacity in addition to their official capacity. And so the argument that the Department of Justice gives here is, well, we have to take time to decide whether or not, because ordinarily if a federal official is sued in their personal capacity, the government wouldn't necessarily step in to defend them, right? So you have most recently, maybe most famous recent example, President Trump is sued civilly with the rape allegations, right? And the Department of Justice stepped in to defend him, and even the Biden administration is continuing that defense. But they don't always defend federal officials who are accused of conduct, and even some of your sort of conduct that happens on your official watch. If you're doing something that's borderline or that goes over the line, you can be sued in your official capacity. But you can also be sued in your personal capacity if it goes far enough out of bounds. And so what DOJ is saying is that they need extra time to make the decision whether they're going to defend you or not. The problem is that they're going to get the benefit of this time delay either way. And that's a problem for, it's already very difficult to win these sort of Bivens cases or qualified immunity kinds of cases against any government official. Very difficult to win these. So I can't imagine that they're coming up that often on appeal where the government has lost. Or I guess these aren't necessarily appeal, these are initial defense. But Vec, what do you make of that? What's the...
So that is, my view is, why they need 60 days. Now they say it's because they represent these people in an individual capacity. They've got to make sure they have, the bells and whistles for that. But since they always get extensions, why do they get 60 days? I've always thought this, the other thing is usually most parties have to have 30 days to answer a complaint, right?
Right.
But the government gets that extra time already. So here, I don't see why an organization that always gets extensions and never has them denied, certainly the first one, right?
Yeah, right. I've never seen a first extension denied to the government. Not that I can think of.
Neither have I. And so, why would they need an extension? Since they, this long 60-day period. And I've brought up before that if you're sued in your individual capacity, it is far more likely that official did something willful on their own that has nothing to do with just the policy. Because otherwise, why are you sued in your individual capacity? We don't do that. We sue in their official capacity unless there's some.
So that's
real
the worst thing. Time for them to get the extra benefit of the doubt, you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And October 5th is when the when the Civil Rules Advisory Committee will be considering this issue. So if this is something folks care about and they want to send a letter to the Civil Rules Advisory Committee to weigh in against this deadline, they really should. I think 14 days is plenty. 60 days is way too much.